On this episode of This Week in Space, we're talking Jupiter with the principal investigator of the Juno mission, Scott Bolton. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 62, recorded on May 19th, 2023. Juno's Jupiter Journey with Dr. Scott Bolton. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. You can get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the That's One Big Planet edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, with the illustrious Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief of space.com. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Rod. I'm doing well. Happy podcast day. So
today we're joined by Dr. Scott Bolton. He's the principal investigator for the Juno mission to Jupiter, assistant vice president of the Southwest Research Institute, artist, entrepreneur, an all-around Renaissance guy. How are you today, Scott?
Hey, doing great. Happy to be here.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. Now, before we begin, I have a new space joke.
And I can't wait.
I will confess that this one came from AI.
Wait, you got a robot to do the joke?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, man, OpenGPT's sense of humor needs a little bit of work. But I got one good one because I didn't have anything from a listener about Jupiter. So, hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
The entire crew of the first crewed mission to Jupiter died upon reaching the planet. I guess nobody quite understood the gravity of the situation. And we're waiting.
Because it's big. Oh, it's got a lot of gravity.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for making it even worse. Okay. As always, we invite you to mention to join Team Tarek and send us your best worst space joke. I guess that was our worst for the quarter. Don't forget, do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and all that podcast stuff for us. After all, it's free, and we love you. On to headlines. NASA picks Blue Origin. What a shock.
That's
and
right.
Friends to build the second Artemis lander. Take it away, Mr. Malik.
Yeah, well, this actually is hot, hot, hot off the presses. It happened actually earlier today. But NASA, you know, they picked Starship a while ago, SpaceX's Starship, to land the Artemis 3 astronauts on the moon. When they finally do get there, maybe in 2025, maybe a little bit later, we're not sure. But one of the things that Senator Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator, said right when he took charge was that they would pick a second one because they want to have a bit of redundancy. And if that sounds familiar, that's what NASA did with the Commercial Crew program, where they picked SpaceX and Boeing at the time. And a lot of people were like, why are you picking SpaceX? You've already got Boeing. That should be great. Well, we know now how good a decision that was, because SpaceX has been flying for years and Boeing still hasn't gotten astronauts off the ground. So they announced this plan for the moon lander, and they decided to go after they had a bunch of entries with Northrop Grumman. You had a Blue Origin with the whole team, Dynetics as well, I believe, was in the mix. And they opted for Blue Origin, this big team led by Blue Origin. And the idea is that they will fly and land the astronauts on Artemis 5. So the Artemis 4 mission is, again, supposed to use a Starship lander, but this will be an Artemis 5 lander, and Blue Origin will launch an actual, like an uncrewed test, as well as other ground-based tests of the vehicle. Before that, it's a $3.4 billion contract, and so that way they'll have this what do you call it, a contingency plan if they ever need to have a backup landing system for either company. So a bit of a suspense when they announced it. It took them a little bit of a time to roll it all out today, but it was pretty exciting. They've at least got that plan in place, and now they can really get started on it going forward. So we'll see, you know, again, how these vehicles do. Blue Origin, they call it an SLD national team. It's Lockheed Martin, Draper, Boeing as well, and Astrobotic and Honeybee Robotics. With Lockheed Martin building basically the transportation like part of it, the transporter that'll refuel the Blue Moon spacecraft that will land the astronauts. And then the other companies are, you know, providing different parts of the vehicle itself. But it is supposed to be reusable, which is a big key selling point for this this lander, just like Starship.
Boeing must have an excellent lobbyist. And that story comes to us courtesy of space.com. Next up, Republican senators claim NASA is being distracted by climate change and diversity initiatives. We can't have that. What's
up? This was a weird one. It was earlier this week, Bill Nelson, the Senate, the NASA administrator, appeared in a Senate Commerce Committee meeting where, you know, it's budget time and they're going around trying to, you know, defend the $27.2 billion budget proposal that NASA has right now for the next fiscal year in 2024. And Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Eric Schmidt of Missouri really kind of laid in to Nelson, not about the delays about getting people to the moon or you know, technology lagging behind, but they were complaining about the agency's focus on quote-unquote climate change, diversity, equity, and inclusion, with Eric Schmidt actually saying that he felt that it was the administration's obsession with these misguided and woke policies that were like slowing all of NASA's progress on its space efforts down, and that they want it to be a laser-like focus. It was just very strange to see, you know, those specific points being pulled out, you know, a focus on climate change, on making sure that the staffing of the agency is a good representation of the population of the country. They are working to be a more sustainable, I guess I should say, agency, where they're trying to monitor their greenhouse gas. They're trying to switch to electric vehicles. A lot of those policies were called out by Ted Cruz and Eric Schmidt in this hearing. And Bill Nelson, you know, for his part, basically really stressed over and over again how NASA is a nonpartisan agency. They're run that way, and that all of these efforts are part of that general mission. But it is something to watch, because you haven't seen this kind of stuff come up in budget discussions in the past. It's mostly been on like the bigger cost missions and international cooperation and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how deep they get into these policies for the budget review is going to remain to be seen over the next few weeks. But we'll have to, or pardon me, the next few months as they finalize the budget there.
So that comes to us from Space News. And Scott, you've worked much closer with NASA than either of us have. Did this provoke any responses in your head when you heard that headline?
Not really. I mean, it's a very complicated organization. Anytime you mix the scientists and engineers with politicians, you know, sometimes it's hard work for everybody around.
Well said. Last up, SpaceX rolls rocket to pad for Sunday's AX2 private astronaut launch with Axiom.
That's right. This is from Axiom Space, from SpaceX as well. And, you know, space.com is writing about it. So I just wanted to make sure that we have a nice reminder to everyone that the next private astronaut launch to the International Space Station lifts off on Sunday afternoon Eastern time from Florida. This is Axiom Space's AX2 mission. It's like a 10-day flight to the space station that is all fully funded by Axiom Space through the customers that they have. They are flying two Saudi astronauts, including the first female astronaut from Saudi Arabia to launch. Rayana Barnawi is her name, and Ali Akarni is the male astronaut for Saudi Arabia. And the pilot is a paying customer, John Schaffner. He's a veteran pilot and an investor who wants to go to space. So he gets to be the pilot for this mission. And leading the crew back from the past is Peggy Whitson, legendary astronaut icon from NASA. You know, she left the agency a bit back. She was the first female chief astronaut of the astronaut corps when she was there at NASA. And now she's going back to the space station where she had a couple of long stays. And my big question is what she packed for her menu, because she is notorious for being a big hot sauce fan up there, and I'm curious if she's packed some along for her crewmates that she's going to join when she gets up there.
That also brought to us by Space, from space.com. All right, we're coming on to the main act, and we'll be back in just a moment after this word from our sponsor, Bitwarden. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. Even our very own security guru, Steve Gibson, has switched. With Bitwarden, all the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. Protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. And you can go further with the username generator. Create unique usernames for each account, or even use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Bitwarden is open source with all the code available on GitHub for anyone to view. This means you don't have to trust their word. You can see that it's completely secure. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed every year, and the results are also published on their website. This is open source security that you can trust. Bitwarden has also launched a new Bitwarden Secrets Manager currently in beta. It's an end-to-end encrypted solution that allows teams of developers to centrally secure, manage, and deploy sensitive secrets like API keys and machine credentials. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of the source code and eliminates the risk of them being exposed to the public. Bitwarden needs developers to help test out the new Secrets Manager and provide feedback. Learn more at bitwarden.com/secretsbeta. Share private security with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 a month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is just $5 a month per user. Individuals can always use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords. You can upgrade at any time to a premium account for less than $1 a month, or bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. That's a bargain you can't pass up. At Twit, we're fans of password managers, and Bitwarden is the only open-source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we are back. So, Dr. Scott Bolton, thank you for joining us today. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You're a fascinating, fascinating man. I'd like to start, if we could, just a brief rundown of who you are, where you work, what you do, and how you got there. How's that for a big one?
Well, I'm Scott Bolton, and I'm the principal investigator of the Juno mission, which is currently orbiting Jupiter as we speak. In fact, we're in an elliptical orbit. And so right now, about every 38 days or so, we get really close to Jupiter and drop down over the poles and get really close. And that just happened this week. On Tuesday or Wednesday, we went by for the 51st time. So that was our 51st orbit. Our plan, of course, was never that long. We're in our extended mission. Now, how I got here? Well, that's another question. It was a bit of a random walk. I went to college at the University of Michigan and then Caltech and UC Berkeley, and then started working at JPL for a long time, and kind of got to learn about how missions were put together. Was on a couple of them scientifically, things like Cassini, which went to Saturn, Cassini-Huygens, and Galileo, which orbited Jupiter. I got there just in time to get on the kind of the last tail end of Voyager. So I got some experience that way, and I did help out with some other missions as well. And then eventually came up with the idea that eventually became Juno, along with a large team. And then it was a long road, you know. In this business, you got to have patience, because your kids grow up while you're working on one single project. Huh. It's pretty amazing. So we started and thought of Juno around the year 2000, 2001. Started putting together the proposal, launched in 2011, you know, because we didn't get selected and start really till 2005. And then about 5 or 6 years later, we launched with a little bit of a delay due to some budget issues that NASA had. So we postponed it a bit. And then we got there in 2016, right on July 4th.
That's right.
people often think, you know, I set that up, but
you must have fired the braking rockets to make sure you didn't get there earlier, right?
Yeah, I don't have as much power as Jupiter's gravity and the sun. So those really dictated our arrival date.
So I think just a quick follow up. I think a lot of people scratch their heads over how a group like the Southwest Institute works with JPL. Cause if you don't really put your head into this stuff all the time, you expect, oh, it's just a JPL thing. It's a NASA thing. But a lot of other groups work with that organization to make these things happen. So you could talk a little bit about the relationship with Southwest Institute with NASA, the project.
Yeah. So when I started out with Juno, I was at JPL, actually. But this is part of a program called New Frontiers, where it's called PI class missions. And you have one scientist that's sort of in charge. And you have a large team made up of people at different institutes, universities, sometimes even foreign space agencies like the Italian Space Agency, the French Space Agency. They all were part of our partnership when we put the idea together. And so JPL, you know, I selected them to do the daily management, basically everyday managing of the mission. And, as the principal investigator, I'm responsible for, you know, if anything goes wrong, so to speak. But you have many different agencies and institutes that are involved. And because I'm an employee at Southwest Research Institute, that's actually what's called the PI Institute. So some of the contract money from NASA that gets that's used to, you know, put together Juno and implement it come through Southwest Research Institute, and they help manage it. A lot of the bulk of it probably goes through JPL, because you have to pay for the spacecraft to be built and pay for the I had to pay for the launch vehicle. I mean, all of that was in the budget. And so Southwest is helping me manage that whole mission, and so is JPL, and in fact, you know, so is NASA, of course, right? They're overseeing it all, and we respond to, converse with them regularly. They have a program office at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask, because you mentioned Scott about just the amount of time it's taken for, you know, to get Juno from that concept, which I imagine the thought process is like, I like Jupiter. Jupiter sounds cool. Let's go there and look. But you know, with a lot of extra science there, tell me about the mission itself. I mean, from what was the nugget, the kernel that really got you into this mission? And then what is Juno doing at Jupiter right now as like the fruition of that nugget idea?
Yeah, those are great questions. So, I had been studying Jupiter and the giant planets, as well as the other planets and even Earth before. But a lot of scientists, you know, if you want to understand where the solar system formed and how planets are made, which is really even more interesting now that we've got great telescopes that are helping us see solar systems that are around other stars, right? We're starting to be able to see those now. And so the question is, where did we come from? How did we get here? How did Earth get here? How did Earth get its oceans? Why is there life here? And it starts with trying to understand how the solar system formed itself. And Jupiter holds a special place in helping with that mystery, because it's the largest of all the planets. It's the most massive. So the idea is that the sun forms from a molecular cloud in some formation, somehow it collapses on itself, or you know, there is a gravitational instability and a star is born. And then there's debris left over that sort of puts out in a disk, dust and gas, things that didn't go into the sun. And from that, the planets are made. And the idea is that Jupiter, because it's the most massive, I mean, all the other planets You could put them all together. They still don't add up to Jupiter. I could add, you know, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, all the asteroids, all the comets, all the Earth, Mars, Venus, and it's still not even half of what Jupiter is. Wow. And so it got most of the leftovers. And the thought is that it probably had to form first because it's so massive. Had the solar system existed and then you try to make Jupiter, you would have almost certainly disrupted everything. And there might not have been all the material. So the idea is it formed first. And so that gives you a very important clue. If you can understand its formation, is how did planets get formed in the first place? And there were a couple of different ideas out there. And so one of the primary objectives of Juno is to study Jupiter so close up that we can investigate the interior, the composition, the atmosphere, and understand how it formed and evolved. And what does that tell us about the early solar system and where the elements and molecules that made us up come from? Jupiter probably, you know, had a major role in all of that. And so a lot of it is who we are, where'd we come from? And Jupiter holds this important key for us.
And you mentioned that Juno is like in a polar orbit, I guess you said earlier. Is it just one basic orbit where it just takes a close look at the same spot on each pass, or are you looking at the entire planet? What types of gear are you using right
so,
now?
So to investigate it, you literally have to map out the planet. Okay, so one of the things we want to do is map out the gravity field, the magnetic field, and really look into the atmosphere deep down. And we're also studying the magnetosphere. Jupiter's a planet on steroids, right? I mean, it is a monster out there. And so everything about it is extreme. And it has the most extreme magnetic field. It has the most extreme gravity field. It has the most extreme radiation environment. So it's a tough place to go. And what we wanted to do was get really close. And so we had to avoid very severe radiation. It's really a nasty place. It's probably the most hazardous place in the whole solar system. And so we come in over the poles and we dive down, sort of sliding almost like a needle right between two tough places. One, the radiation belts, and then the atmosphere, right? So if we hit the atmosphere, we'll hit drag and it'll destroy our orbit. If we hit the radiation, our electronics are gone. So we kind of slice right between, and then the orbit's elliptical. So it goes out, it's polar, as you point. So we come in over the North Pole and out the South Pole. And the orbit started out being 53 days long. And now it's 38. And what shrunk it was us going close to the satellites during our extended mission, first Ganymede, then Europa. But basically, Jupiter drives the entire orbit for us. Okay, so we're over the poles. And what we do is we time it so that we go over the poles, but we come down across one particular longitude. Right. And then the orbit, even though it was 53 days long, it was timed in such a way so that when we came back the next time around, we would go over a different longitude. Mm-hmm. And we eventually wanted to create a little net around the entire planet so that we were sampling all the longitudes. Right. Because if you were trying to make a map of Earth and you kept going over Hawaii, it wouldn't help you that much, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of spread it around. So Jupiter's spinning every 10 hours, roughly. And so we timed all that. You know, the navigation engineers figured out a little way to do that. And so we did it in a way that we kind of mapped it out at a coarser resolution with the first 16 orbits. And then the next 16, we went right in between the other longitudes so that we would get double the resolution. And now we're making even more, finely mapped. And when you do that, you start to learn about the gravity field. Most of that's symmetric, but not all of it. We learn about the magnetic field, which is very asymmetric. And so we're trying to understand how magnetic fields are made. We see features. We discovered this feature we call the Great Blue Spot. Everybody's heard of the Great Red Spot, right? It's a giant storm that's hundreds of years, right? The Great Red Spot. It's actually changing. We're seeing it shrink, but generally it's just lasted for a really long time. Well, with the magnetic field, we discovered something called the Great Blue Spot, which was a place that was like almost like a magnetic pole that we didn't really realize existed. And it's a large asymmetry in Jupiter's magnetic field, which is also going around every 10 hours. Every so often, it lines up with the Great Red Spot, and it's a little bit south, like the Great Red Spot. I often wonder if they're coupled together. We can see distortions in that Great Red, in that Great Blue Spot, that look like it's being torn apart by the winds, the jet streams that we know as Jupiter's zones and belts. Right? If you look at Jupiter, it has these beautiful stripes. And those stripes are basically jet streams that go down into the planet thousands of kilometers. They eventually break, and the wind must slow down. It's we now think it's the magnetic field that's probably driving, you know, slowing that down, because eventually it gets to a place where it can't move the magnetic field around. The wind's not strong enough, but it can distort the magnetic field a little bit. And so we see, we're so close to Jupiter, we're actually seeing an interaction between the magnetic field and the atmosphere, right? Which is really new. Another big thing is trying to understand whether Jupiter has a core of heavy elements in the center of it. And so we set out to discover whether there was a core, a rocky core, so to speak, in the middle, like many other planets have, or none. And the previous spacecraft were unable to do that. The idea being that if there was a core of rocky elements or heavy elements in the middle, then that means that Jupiter might have originally formed by, you know, a collection of rocky objects like small asteroids or something that sort of bump into each other, collect up, make enough of a mass that you could then collect the gas and dust from the leftovers after the sun. Turned out that we weren't right. There wasn't a small compact core or no core. Instead, there's this large diffuse core that seems to be like almost half the planet, and there's gradients in it. And so that was such a new idea that theorists are still struggling, trying to come up with how do you make a planet like that?
Like a slushy, you mean, when you say diffuse core, instead of like a diamond at the center?
So a little bit like a slushy. It's like a slushy that's melted on one side, right, and frozen at the bottom, and it's all slush in the middle. Of course, Jupiter's, it's gas and liquid. It's not exactly slushy like, but yeah, it's like this mixture, and you know, maybe there's little lumps in it, but we don't see that. But we definitely see gradients, which we didn't really foresee, and no models really had that in them for Jupiter. Huh. And Saturn was a kind of a surprise as well. With Cassini, we saw something similar, also this sort of diffuse core, but still very different than Jupiter.
So I want to get back to the science, but I want to diverge for a moment to JunoCam, which is still, it's science, but it wasn't its primary focus, as I understand it. So I thought that was a wonderful story, and it reminded me of another story, which, if I may diverge for just a moment, when I was a kid, I did a science project in eighth grade about astrophotography. And I was lucky enough by hook or by crook to get Robert Layton out of Caltech to help me and let me use his telescope when I was this obnoxious little kid. And he was one of the primary figures on Mariner 4. And I didn't realize till much later that he was also one of the people that said, look, you know, we went to Venus with Mariner 2. We did squiggly line science. That was great. We really need a camera. You know, if you want to take the public along, we need a camera. So it's 1962 at this point, 63, and they have to develop this kind of space-proof Plumicon video tube, which was quite a feat. But, you know, the pictures, even though we only got 21 or 22 of them, were a big deal. So then I hear about JunoCam going along as kind of a public outreach instrument on Juno, and I thought, This is new NASA. This is brilliant. You know, this is where outreach, especially when you get citizen science involved, this is really just such a huge thing. And then those first pictures came in from the poles of all these little hexagonal storms and so forth. And it was jaw dropping. I mean, there have been some big moments just personally for me in space flight, space exploration over the years, of course, Apollo 11 and Viking and all that. But that was one of them, seeing this incredible mysterious beauty coming in after you process these images was just jaw dropper. So I wonder if you could talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, we all were amazed when we first saw those pictures too. I mean, it was just jaw dropping, like you said, and you saw these polar cyclones, and nobody had any idea of what Jupiter look like at the poles? And so when we were putting together the mission, as you pointed out, the camera was put on in order mainly because we all wanted to see what the poles look like. And we figured so did everybody else. And if, of course, if you're going to connect to the public, you got to have a camera. And the way, the mission came to be is, you know, NASA had a kind of a sketch of an idea that we had helped with about the science that we would do. And a camera wasn't really required for the science objectives. But I couldn't imagine, and nobody else on the team could either, that we could go there without carrying one. So we slipped it in as a as an educational outreach tool. And I, you know, worked with Mike Malin, who built a lot of the cameras for the Mars missions at the time, and said, you know, can you give me something simple? You know, I can't carry science requirements on it. We'll make it easy to build, but, you know, we really need a simple camera that, you know, can capture these pictures. And he's like, yeah, well, let's do it. Let's do it. And of course, I didn't tell him, oh, we're going to be spinning. So it needs to, you know, I was like, oh, we need a simple camera. We'll just take a copy of what you've got from Mars. And he's like, okay, I can do that. And then I was like, oh, but we're spinning twice a minute. Does that matter? And he's like, oh yeah, that matters. I need to collect the data a bit different. And I said, oh, and I'd like, you know, can you throw a methane filter onto it too? So we could see, do a little bit of science in the sneak. And he's like, yeah, we do. I mean, he delivered. It was great. His whole team is awesome. And the camera had very unique requirements. It wasn't like any other space camera that really went out. And it was largely because, one, it was outreach focused, and two, we were going really fast and spinning, right? And I wanted a picture of the pole. So I calculated the distance that we were over the pole roughly. And I said, look, we got one shot. We have no spacecraft. We can't do mosaics. I can't move the spacecraft around to take a bunch of pictures. I don't have a scan platform like Cassini and Galileo had where you could move and do mosaics. I said, so I need a framing, you know, that I can capture, you know, all of Jupiter's pole from this distance, one shot. And they said, well, we have, you know, okay, we'll make it like that. And then we started looking at it. It's a lot like your smartphone framing, you know, so it's really good for, you know, tourist pictures, right? And so we're tourists of Jupiter, you know. And so all those pictures, now it's turned out to be this incredible scientific tool as well, right? Everybody kind of knew that it was going to be that way, but we literally didn't have a JunoCam science team tied to this. We started analyzing it. And so then I said, well, I really want to just reach out to the public. And I had been part of, Cassini-Huygens, where some data on the probe accidentally got out. When they were landing on the moon Titan, and I discovered the public were making these little movies from this data before the science team could. And so I said, you know, what if we designed it this way? I bet the public would make all the pictures for us. So we put together this whole program, and indeed they, you know, citizen scientists now, I mean, I don't think the term was around back when we first did this, but it was kind of new to NASA as well, but it's turned out to be a good success. And now there's a lot of people trying to work out citizen scientists. So I'm glad that we could help motivate and inspire that. And the one of the most rewarding things is, I would say, you know, half the pictures are people trying to do science, you know, or trying to make a beautiful picture. And the other ones are inspired in doing art. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all over the map. You'll see pictures of, you know, things that come out that are just using your imagination. And it's, some of them are using their raw data. Some of them are using, you know, data that's put together. They stretch the colors. They put their cat into the picture. I mean, you can see all kinds of great stuff, but those pictures, those first pictures of the poles were jaw dropping. I mean, and then we saw them in the infrared, right? Because we have an infrared instrument. And so you could see the whole thing in the infrared, whereas the JunoCam, half of it was nighttime, right? Half was daytime because you're looking at the pole. Mm. But boy, when you see all those cyclones at the top, it's just like, wow, how did those get there?
How did they get there?
Well, there are theories being worked that they naturally evolve, but I mean, I think it's all new. You know, our big question was, how stable are they? How long are they going to last? There were eight at the north circling around a center one. So, and they were distributed evenly. So they were like at the points of an octagon. And then on the south, when we went over that and we took pictures of it, there's only five, going around a center one, and the five are also distributed almost perfectly, like a points of a pentagon. So this geometry is just natural. They're giant polar cyclones. They have been around and are basically lasting since we discovered them in 2016. We see sometimes they are changing a little bit, and sometimes it looks like there's a space opening up and a new one is going to form, because we wondered, you know, why eight, why five? And but then by the time we come around again, that new one is gone, and it's back to the eight. And so it's a very exclusive club. They just don't let anybody in, I guess, you know, and they're, you know, they're shielded. I mean, there's a whole physics of how vortices work. And there's these things called vortex crystals. It's a lot of really cool fluid mechanics. And, that also drives, you know, phenomena that we see in the ocean. Sometimes Jupiter's cyclonic storms look a little bit like Earth's oceans, you know, at a different scale. So it's really amazing.
Yeah, I have to say that the JunoCam story is one where I have to eat my hat, because as you mentioned, Scott, you know, it was an outreach camera. And I remember complaining very loudly before launch to my news team that there wasn't like this super high powered mega, you know, video HD plus whatever it was back then camera that we were going to get pictures from. And there was this outreach camera. And it's like, oh, I guess that's all we're going to get. They're going to go all the way to Jupiter with this outreach camera. And then those photos came and they were spectacular. And then there was the one with the cat. There was like a Jimi Hendrix one with like super psychedelic colors. And it was just amazing. And it was so much more fun to see the imagery coming down. And the cyclones that you were mentioning earlier, really, like, I remember when those the studies came out to show like all the different wavelengths and how it just looked really, really strange. And it just made me think about how Juno has shown a Jupiter that is very different from the one that I read about in the books from, you know, Pioneer, from Voyager, and then of course later from Galileo. Because if you think of the cloud bands and you've got the spot and that's pretty much it, but you're talking about these weird, beautiful structures at the top and bottom of that planet that that have like lives of their own that you're getting a glimpse on. It just seems amazing. I guess there's not a question there. I'm just like marveling at the planet right now.
Well, I mean, it is. It's like a Van Gogh painting. In fact, there are some people that have put on our website, you know, things that tie to Van Gogh, because, you know, the brush strokes are very similar, almost like he had a vision. And I think, you know, when I think back, I mean, you know, some of it was serendipitous. I would like to say, oh, I knew all this was going to be this way and I was brilliant. But no, we put on this thing. I told you the motivation. I wanted to get a shot of the poles. But all this other came out of it. And it came out because that camera had very special properties compared to the normal cameras that we send on, you know, spacecraft, which are very high resolution, very, you know, there'll be a narrow angle and a wide angle and a scan platform there. And they're very expensive. We just literally couldn't fit in the budget. It's not one of those. But now I look at the value of this, and where we get shots of Jupiter, they're wider. So you can understand the context and appreciate the beauty. And I can even make films of flying around Jupiter, right? Like you're on the spacecraft. And so we're able to do things that other missions weren't able to do because they had different kinds of cameras. I think one of these kind of cameras should be on every mission, because there's an aspect to it that you connect to the public, but it's not just that. It helps your understanding to see things in a broader context. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very happy with it. And, you know, we take advantage of all the art stuff, but we also take, I've been able to make movies of flying around, you know, and put them to music and, you know, put them on YouTube and they go viral and it's inspiring, you know. There was one other special thing that came out of that camera that we didn't, you know, plan for at before launch, but turned out was a great idea. We knew we wanted to take some images of approach because there were famous movies of from Voyager of approaching Jupiter, and you see these bands swirling around and the winds are going back and forth in different directions. And so I kind of wanted to be able to do that. But we had another idea because we had this very wide field of view, right? That it wasn't ordinary, and we could dump the data down quickly because there weren't huge files that we couldn't downlink, so we could take many pictures. So on approach, for 2 weeks, we took a photo of Jupiter's system every 15 minutes as we came in, and then collapsed it down to a 3-minute movie. And what you're able to see is Jupiter, you know, half of Jupiter lit up, you know, because you're coming in from the side. And then you watch the four Galilean satellites. They look like little dots, and you can watch them orbit. It's the first time we had a movie of celestial bodies moving, right? Everything else is still. Once in a while, you get a little occultation or some kind of a passing. But this is a whole movie of whole orbits, right? And so you see Io going around every, you know, day and a three quarters, and then Europa's going a little bit slower than Ganymede, and then finally Callisto. They go in behind Jupiter in eclipse, and you're watching these orbits. And I realized this is what Galileo must have imagined when he realized we weren't the center. And now we're able to watch it, you know? So that, you know, we released that. It went viral like in 2016 when we were approached. I saved that movie and we released it. And I think it's really moving because it shows not only what Jupiter looks like, but this is what the cosmos really must look like from afar. Our solar system must look like this if you are outside looking in.
So one of the things that I found fascinating was the amount of attention. I mean, your mission, I think, had a lot more bandwidth than what was going on with Galileo, because besides being older, it had, you know, antenna problems and so forth. But the amount of work and attention paid to things like the boundaries between bands and how they shear and how they interact and all these visible visual astronomy dynamics of the planet. What do you learn from looking at the atmospheric interactions that are so complex?
Well, we're literally learning about how the weather works on Jupiter, how deep it goes. The atmosphere works so differently than we imagined. You know, the whole concept, one of the early concepts of when the Galileo mission went to Jupiter is it carried a probe. And it was there for the same reasons that I mentioned earlier about our interest in the formation. They wanted to learn about what Jupiter was made out of so they could figure out how it formed. And the Galileo probe dropped in. And the concept was that, well, you know, as it passes through different clouds, it's getting warmer as you go down into Jupiter. And so the water starts off as ice and then liquid and eventually is gas. Ammonia does the same thing. Lots of different volatiles do that. And the idea was, is that once you drop below the cloud deck, it would all be well mixed. Well, Galileo's result, the probe results were confusing and nobody really understood them. And so that was part of the motivation for Juno. When we got there, we had a special instrument that was invented for Juno that could look beneath into the cloud base, deep down, hundreds of kilometers down. We saw that it wasn't constant and uniform. It wasn't homogeneous. It was a very, very spotty, and we couldn't understand, we still don't fully understand how it could be so variable deep down. And so part of what you're learning by looking at this microwave instrument plus the visible light plus the infrared cameras and spectrometers, we're learning how these weather patterns work, how deep the storms go. Some of them go quite deep. The Great Red Spot got pretty deep roots. Some of these, we're about to learn how deep the polar cyclones go, because we have to resolve them with our microwave, and we're slowly getting closer and closer. But you also are learning how these beautiful folded filamentary regions, this beautiful Van Gogh-like structure gets formed. We've actually seen cyclonic spots that sort of start out as a simple oval, And then in a year or two, they're destroyed into these beautiful features, like you're painting and using an oil painting, right? And you're also seeing that the different colors of Jupiter's cloud structure are actually different depths. So a lot of times the beautiful things that you see that look like the Van Gogh painting are actually looking at different windows. Some of them you're seeing deeper down and it's a little different color. Some of them are higher up. We actually see shadows. And so there's a whole program to try to calculate the height of some of these clouds and these pop-up white clouds. We see a lot of lightning coming from there. There's lightning all over the place on Jupiter. I mean, it's a really turbulent place.
Well, I know Tarek's got a burning question in his turbulent mind, so we'll be back in just a moment after this word from our sponsor. All right, Tarek.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what, Scott, you were talking about earlier about just the storms themselves. I mean, I can't even deal with a storm that lasts more than a couple of days here in New Jersey. But at Juno, you've been watching the same storms for years as they go through, I guess, their daily motions. And with the Great Red Spot, I mean, it's been a lot longer than that. And yet, and like you mentioned, it's shrinking. And I'm just curious, what is it about Jupiter or just these giant planets themselves that lend them like that, where you that lend themselves to having such long lived storms, and what you've learned about how they work, that they're able to last so long?
So I think that's one of the outstanding questions is, you know, how did the Great Red Spot last so long? I don't think there's a clear answer there. I think it probably has to do with the roots, how deep they are, and something's, you know, feeding that and maintaining it. But I don't think we have a good understanding. There are ideas that it's caught between two belts and a belt and a zone that are moving in different directions. And so it's kind of trapped and semi-stable. But you don't see a lot of the other ones that are going 300 years or longer, right? The Great Red Spot was detected basically from the first telescope that we had that could resolve something like that. And so we're still, you know, trying to learn this. There seems to be a stability. I think part of the answer is that the atmosphere Jupiter is just a giant ball of gas, right? Pretty deep down. I mean, it eventually you get down far enough, and I mean thousands of bars pressure, so thousands of even kilometers. You get to a place where the hydrogen is so under such great pressure that it becomes, you know, metallic, like it almost behaves like what we would think of Mercury, right? There are theories about eddies that come up from the magnetic field from below that are causing some of these cyclones. Some think that they're created simply by, you know, motion at the top. But why they're stable, why they last so long, I don't think anybody really knows. We're investigating the polar cyclones for the first time, and they seem to have had this life since we got there. We see a little change. So maybe they're like the Great Red Spot. I mean, I would hesitate to say after, because I've watched them for 7 or 8 years, that they lasted 300. But there is something special. And it's the roots and the amount of energy that is available at Jupiter is just much greater than the amount of energy that we have on our atmosphere.
So I want to make sure we save a little bit of time at the end here to talk about some of your more artistic endeavors, because I know that's a big part of what you do. But I feel like we sort of stepped past the measurements of Jupiter's gravitational and magnetic fields a little bit, which is, of course, a huge part of this mission. So maybe you can address some of what that told you about the planet.
Yeah. So the gravity field was really important. The way we get that is we fly really close and we measure what's called the Doppler shift, from the communication signal to the spacecraft and the Earth. So the spacecraft is communicating to the Earth as we fly by back and forth, and we emit at a very specific frequency. And because, the spacecraft is moving a little bit toward us or away from us, that frequency shifts. And so we can learn about how the mass is distributed inside the planet. And from that, you can learn a lot. So one of the things that we learn from that is whether or not it has a core and what the properties of that core are like. So that kind of turned a lot of theories upside down, right? Because we didn't understand what we were seeing, and we still don't. There's another aspect of that. We were able to use that kind of information to also see how deep the zones and belts go. So we were tying the gravity to the atmosphere. So you see these zones and belts, these are jet streams going back and forth. And the question was, is, you know, how deep do they go? Are they going all the way down, or are they just slicing the surface? And we were able to constrain that they go down about 3,000 kilometers, right? We also saw a mass that seemed to be connected to the Great Red Spot. So that told us how deep its roots were. We also could look at that with the microwave instrument that saw through the clouds, and they both came out about the same. And it goes down pretty far, you know, maybe 300 kilometers or something. So that's a pretty deep route. The magnetic field is coupled to that interior structure as well. So partway down, maybe 9/10 of the way down or 1/10 of the way down into Jupiter, I would say, you start to get places where the magnetic field is probably created. And one of the puzzling and amazing things is that the magnetic field is not, is very complex and asymmetric. And so you normally would have expected, you know, Jupiter, and when we look at it from afar, it looks very what we would call dipolar. So if you played with the a bar magnet in school with iron filings, you saw those dipole lines. And the Earth's got a magnetic field that's mostly dipolar. And Jupiter, we thought, was mostly that way with a little bit of a tilt. And but there's a lot of asymmetries there. And that magnetic field is driving a lot of information and a lot of energy that's going on, as well as connecting out away from Jupiter into the overall magnetosphere where the satellites and rings reside, right? So the whole thing is a giant system. It's like an engine, right? And in fact, when you look at Jupiter's aurora, you can see the footprints of the satellites. So there's like an umbilical cord that's made up of the magnetic field that connects Io, Europa, and Ganymede to Jupiter. So there's a magnetic field line there, or that almost provides a conduit of charged particles into the atmosphere to make aurora. So there's a large connection when you look at Jupiter between the magnetic field, the atmosphere, and the interior. And that's really brand new with Juno. I mean, we knew some of these existed, but traditionally, like on Voyager, Galileo, and Cassini, the scientists would get divided up into groups, and the people that studied the atmosphere did that. The interior was another group. Satellites was another group. You know, the magnetosphere was another group. And we started off that way, and then we started realizing that we were discovering things where one was affecting the other, and it was because nobody had really gotten close enough with sensitive enough instruments to detect this. And so our entire science team sort of got reorganized, where nobody wants to meet separate and miss the other disciplines' discussions because they know they need to hear them because they're interacting with them. And so we've kind of grouped together this new interdisciplinary approach to understanding the planet. And I think that, you know, that's a step that probably planetary scientists will not go back to the other way now. It'll always just keep moving forward when you look at a giant planet and its system, of trying to understand it together, because they are coupling, and we're seeing that for the first time. And that's part of is just the orbit that we chose, but also the set of instruments.
You know, I wanted to ask about the system, because we've been talking about Jupiter a lot. But, you know, as we're recording this week, Juno flew by Io. I got nice close to that most volcanic part of our solar system. You've had flybys of Europa and Ganymede as well. And I'm just curious, you know, how those have gone. And you got to look at these satellites up close, you know, for the first time with the system that you have on board.
Yeah, that was another great thing. I mean, you know, I'd love to say I imagined this when we were starting off, but, you know, our original plan was stay away from the satellites because we don't want our orbit to change and it'll interfere with our investigation of Jupiter. But in the summer of 2021, we were transitioning between the prime mission, which we had finally completed, 32 equally spaced orbits to map out the planet. And we said, okay, we're going to, our orbit is twisted around because Jupiter is so massive. And we are now going to cross the equatorial plane of Jupiter near the distance of Ganymede. And so we said to the navigation team, can we get close to Ganymede instead of avoiding it? And so the whole extended mission took on this flavor where we'll continue to study Jupiter and get closer and closer to the northern hemisphere. But we also went by Ganymede, Europa close. So we've learned a huge amount because we flew by and we have very unique instrumentation and we were coming at a very different angle. So we got the images, which saw new things at higher resolution of some territories, but you also made maps in the infrared. We looked at aurora, but we also looked at the charged particles and looked at the interaction with the magnetosphere. And maybe most importantly, the brand new thing was this microwave instrument, which was invented to see into the clouds of Jupiter, right beneath them. When it looks at the ice shells of Ganymede and Europa, it sees into those as well.
Huh.
So we're probing into the ice shells to see what the subsurface fracturing and characteristics are like. And, you know, we're still analyzing this. It's brand new. I mean, when you invent a new instrument, you don't really know how to interpret the data. It takes a little while. But this is an incredible tool that not only works for atmospheres, but solid icy bodies. And so we see that Ganymede structure, you know, it has dark and light terrain, and the structure underneath looks different as well. So there's different kinds of cracks and fracturing and reflections going on, depending on what type of terrain you're in. And also we see, we can make an estimate of how thick the conductive ice shell is. We haven't published the final paper. We're still kind of arguing back and forth of what the number is, but it's, you know, somewhere between 50 and 150 kilometers thick, this ice shell. And then you're going to get to an ocean. And Europa's, when we went by Europa, the ice shell looks very different than Ganymede. One, it was much more uniform, so you didn't have all these different terrain types. There's a little bit there, but they're all kind of the same. And we see it get very uniform somewhere around 8 to 10 kilometers down, which we don't know if the fracturing is getting annealed and going away, or whether we're getting closer to where there's some liquid. Because if you ever got to a place with liquid with this instrument, it would be like a mirror, and it would just reflect, and we'd know from looking at the spectrum right away we hit liquid. And so next up, you know, we're, as you say, we're flying by Io at a distance. So we've gone many times between 100,000, and this last one was 35,000 kilometers. We started out like 180, a couple hundred thousand actually, and we keep making maps of the volcanic material, right? We're watching them. The volcanoes turn on and off, turn on and off. We also went over the pole for the first time. So we had never seen any maps of Io like that. This last one was 35,000 kilometers. So the resolution is, we're starting to see the lava flows and the shapes of the calderas, which is amazing. And, but in December, we'll fly by at a distance of 1,500 kilometers. And then again in February, we're going to try to understand and measure the internal or interior structure of Io to determine whether the magma is a global ocean or in little pockets. But we also will do a lot with just mapping out and measuring the heat flux. And one of the big questions that we have is, okay, so when we take this new instrument, we're starting to see what it's like to interpret ice. And we know what it's like to look at big, thick atmospheres. What's it going to be like when you look at lava? And so I'm already realizing I need to calibrate this, right? So I'm forming calibrations where I take this instrument and, you know, ground-based versions of it and put it into a chamber and look at ice and try to understand what we saw at Ganymede and Europa. But now I'm looking and saying, could I fly some of this thing over, you know, a volcano of Hawaii? Because I'm going to need some calibration. What am I seeing? So it's very exciting to go by the satellites, and then we're slowly getting even into the rings of Jupiter. Yeah. So we're going to, you know, this mission has turned out to be, you know, a full system explorer. I mean, that was one of the NASA quotes was, you know, when we went into the extended mission, we added to Jupiter and the magnetosphere, the satellites and the ring system. It's more, you know, it's like what a flagship does.
So we're just about up against our time here, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk, to address, as I earlier said, you're quite the Renaissance man, and you've been involved in art projects and music projects and an amazing variety of stuff regarding not just Jupiter, but your take on science in general, I think. Can you talk a little bit about what's new there?
Yeah, well, I'm constantly trying to work and push the envelope of the intersection between art and science. And the art includes, you know, music, as well as, you know, paintings, sculptures, anything that is really touching your emotion and helping us describe our feelings and express ourselves. And I think it's really important because I think there is a very strong interaction between these two, and nature itself provides this for us, right? And so, you know, whatever you study, it's important to look at it from all perspectives if you're going to learn from it. And artists have a certain perspective. Scientists have another, engineers have another, you know, no matter what you do in your life, you're looking at it from a different angle than someone else. And together, of course, we're much more powerful than we are apart. And this was the goal of, you know, Renaissance. I mean, I am flattered that you call me a Renaissance man. I'm not sure how true that is, but I certainly appreciate the Renaissance. And, you know, the Greek and Italian Renaissances was a period where we exploded with, increasing our awareness, right, of many, many topics at once. And so you had, you know, Galileo pushing the envelope in science, you had people pushing engineering, you had Michelangelo doing art, and, you know, the Greeks used to get together with philosophers and mathematicians and artists and musicians and, you know, have giant conferences and talk to each other. And that's the kind of forum I'm trying to create, is not just within our team, but out in the public, because I think that innovation comes from the mixture of creativity and logic, right? And so if you are somebody that you know thinks logically and it happens to be good in, you know, I don't know, analytical thinking, right? Make friends with some artists, because together you're gonna push the envelope into new places that you couldn't do alone. If you're lucky enough to have it all, then still mix with people, you know. But I do believe that mixing analytical reasoning and creativity leads to new innovations and ideas. And of course, I think we're in a renaissance right now, right? Where it's exploding our awareness. It goes well beyond social media, the ability to communicate across the globe like we've never been able to do. But we're also increasing our, you know, you have smartphones that can communicate well, but you can look up almost any information, right? There's no reason to memorize the capital of some state. I can look it up in about 3 seconds. So I'm free to start thinking of more complex topics. And so I'm hoping, you know, school children will learn differently even. And there's an intersection between science and art, and it goes all the way to nature, where if I look at how colors or sound work, it all has to do with vibration. So sound is an air pressure. It's just vibrating, and colors are different colors of light, and they're basically like a vibration. And you goes all the way back to your simple math. If I want to describe mathematically the how the sound of a guitar string or a piano string, I pluck it and it vibrates, right? And I can look at harmonics or not harmonics, and I can watch this sound wave go back and forth, and eventually it moves the air waves and goes into my ear. And if I go to that same thing and I say, okay, if I want to describe the interior of Jupiter or the interior of a black hole, it actually needs to do the same thing, except in harmonics, instead of it being one or two dimensional, it's spherical. And so Jupiter and black holes and the galaxies are sitting there vibrating, going back and forth, just like the guitar string is, just like the different colors of a painting are, you know, doing that to my eye. And so, you know, when you start to appreciate that, math is one tool. You shouldn't be afraid of it, you know, but the thing is that maybe math is hard for some people. And so I advocate, you know, when you mix in the art and the science together, that you try to understand the concept intuitively of what's going on. Forget the math. if it's difficult for you, and try to think about what's actually happening in nature. And so that little movie that I talked about, you can go to YouTube and see the Juno Approach movie, and you'll see these moons going around Jupiter. That's showing you the motion of the cosmos. That's how nature works. It's how we kind of think. It's not a very perfect analogy, but it's kind of how we think an atom works too, right? Is we don't, you have this sketch in your mind. So I don't know if I'm getting to where you wanted on the intersection of
well,
music, but
you're giving us the best rap we've ever had on a podcast, I think. So thank you. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today for our chat with who surely must be the boss of the king of the solar system, Scott Bolton. Scott, where can we best keep track of your upcoming adventures and the book that I know you're going to write?
Well, you can follow Juno by going to missionjuno.com. And when you go there, you not only can see what we've been doing lately, but you can also make your own pictures. And, you know, the beautiful thing is if you go in and make a picture, you're the first one to see that.
Yeah.
And so you get to be part of the discovery. And when we get a new picture of some, like when we go by Io, go make that picture. You're the first one that's seeing it in decades. And we're going to go by really close. And so you can do that going over the Jupiter's poles. You can do it anywhere you wish, whatever image you love. Play with it. You don't have to. You can go to the raw data, or you can go take a picture that somebody else made and play with it with Photoshop. It's, you know, there's no limit. I am working on some books and different things. I don't really have a website that describes mine. I used to do a tweet, and but things kind of got unraveled when everything changed on Twitter. And so I have to get started on that again.
Okay. Maybe Mastodon. Tark?
Yeah. Yes, well, I am at space. Where you can find my work at space.com, as always. And on Twitter, still at Tarek J. Malik there. The J this week stands for Jupiter, of course. And this looking ahead to the next one, right?
Okay. And although I'm embarrassed.
Jupiter, yeah. By Jove is what
you're
I should say.
You're getting crickets, my friend. And although I'm loath to mention my website in the same conversation as Scott's accomplishments, you can always find me at pilebooks.com and, of course, at astromagazine.com. Do not forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. Yes, that's twis@twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas. Also, don't forget to check out space.com. As mentioned, the website's the name. And the National Space Society at NSS.org. Both are good places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings. And just one last mention, because I won't be here next week. It'll be Tarek solo. The National Space Society's annual International Space Development Conference starts next week in Dallas, Texas on Thursday. If you're interested in attending, go to isdc23.nss.org for more info. If you do decide to come by, be sure to say hello. I'll be there all week. New episodes publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so be sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and give us reviews. We always appreciate that. And remember, you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free and outtakes from this show on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there for just $7 a month. Finally, you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook, and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.